ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Australia's always been the lucky country. Sunshine, beaches, and that one magpie that always seems to know where you live.
Yeah, get away from my chip, please. Luck might not cut it anymore.
So can we make our own luck and turn this complicated world to our advantage?
That's our global roaming summer season. Can Australia surf the world's chaos without wiping out?
Fresh new episodes all summer. Search for Global Roaming on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Saturday Extra with me, Nick Brandt, broadcasting from Gadigal Land in Sydney on this, the 3rd of January. Happy New Year from all of us on the team. Coming up, the global figures we interviewed last year who are at the very top of their fields. The journalist Maria Ressa, who in 2021 was awarded the Nobel Prize for Peace.
The rights you voluntarily give up is so hard to reclaim. I've learned this, right? I still have one court case left. It's at the Supreme Court, the Court of Last Appeal. I still have to ask for permission to travel outside the Philippines.
And we'll talk to the author, Colin McCann, whose novels like A Paragon and Let the Great World Spin have made him one of the world's most admired novelists.
These are rough times. These are wounded times. These are shattered times. So what do I do as a novelist? And I stumbled upon a story about cable ships, that ships, of all things, ships that go out to repair the internet.
But first, the giant of the world of architecture, Lord Norman Foster, who in 1999 won the coveted Pritzker Prize. He's designed Apple stores, its circular headquarters in California, the Reichstag building in Berlin, Wembley Stadium, the so-called Gherkin Tower in the City of London. Last year, he celebrated his 90th birthday, and I caught up with him during a visit to Seoul in South Korea. Lord Foster, thanks so much for joining us on Saturday Extra.
Very good.
One of the reasons we're speaking to you today is because there's an exhibition of your work at the building in Sydney which houses the Gadigal Metro Station. It's been very popular with critics and the public alike. I wonder what the formula is in your mind for a successful building that hits that sweet spot, critical acclaim and public acclamation.
It's a combination of things. I suppose that if you take the metro, then if the metro guides you to your destination and you don't have to think too much, it's more intuitive, then you're going to feel more reassured. Really, it comes down to the core issue that everything is design. And if it's well designed, then it makes you feel good. It improves the quality of your life. And you don't really think about it. Now, of course, it's a sliding scale. You can create those spaces where you enter and you think, wow. I mean, it is the cliche, the wow factor, which is perhaps more the element of surprise. And if you think of buildings like, say, the Guggenheim in New York, you go through a low space and then you explode into that dynamic space. Mm. So it is the control of space and sometimes the movement through something which is quite intimate into something which is grander in scale. So it's really a fusion of the function and the desire to make something beautiful. So something that works in the material world and something that also works in the spiritual world.
I've heard you say that it's not just function, it is not just form, that feel is just as important.
Yes, I mean, we do have an emotional relationship with nature. If we're aware of the changing of the seasons, I mean, right now here in Seoul, it's autumn. You know, the leaves are turning and you are aware of it. And people are talking about it over dinner. You know, it's beautiful colors outside. So it is a relationship with nature, the magic of a view. We know, for example, that a patient that's had surgery and recovers in a room with a view will leave hospital earlier than somebody who doesn't have a view, will use less painkillers. So Now, all of this has been quantified. Of course, those of us as designers, perhaps in the past, going back to the 60s or 70s, we believed passionately that if you had that contact with nature, natural light, natural ventilation, a glimpse of a view, that it would be good for you. Now we know scientifically that it really is.
I want to take you back to your childhood and the views that you were looking out upon in your childhood. You are now a lord, you are now a knight, two of the highest honours that Britain can bestow, but you come from a working class background in Manchester. You grew up in a terraced house. I wonder how that upbringing shaped you as a designer.
I think we're all products of our background and influences, and obviously parental influences, a work ethic, a sense of values. I think those cut across really all levels of society. But growing up, like many of my generation, I had construction sets. I was fascinated by locomotives. I happened to live adjacent to a railway line. So cars, automobiles, buildings, before I really ever discovered architecture as a profession, I had a real enjoyment of buildings. I mean, my first experience of a building was Manchester Town Hall as a work of architecture, because I left school at 16 and worked as an office boy in the town hall. And I still have very vivid memories of that. But I didn't think at the time this was great architecture. But I certainly was aware of the details, of the feeling of that place. And it certainly moved me emotionally.
It's an industrial landscape that we associate with the art of L.S. Lowry, a painter famed for his matchstick men and women and matchstick cats and dogs. And I understand you own one of his works now. It's a heritage that you clearly hold dear.
Well, my wife bought me an early Lowry as a birthday present, as a reminder of my of Lowry really being a favourite artist when I was growing up. But I never, ever thought at the time that I might be privileged to own a Lowry. So that's, yes, it's a very nice connection. Lowry, still the paintings I find extraordinary, the way in which they capture that gritty urbanity of the industrial north.
You said there that you left school at 16. You did not have the qualifications to go to university, and yet you made it to university. You studied architecture at Manchester University in your hometown. I wondered how you made that transition from the kid who left school at 16 to the guy that managed to get a qualification in architecture.
Well, I left school at 16. I was 2 years in Manchester Town Hall, and then I did 2 years national service, which was compulsory at that time. And I was a radar technician, which was the kind of hot science of that time. And then in the year after that, not returning to the town hall, I discovered architecture as a profession. Slightly complicated story, but having discovered that you could go to a school of architecture in Manchester, there were two schools. There was the art school, which was funded by the Manchester Education Authority, and there was the university. I didn't have the qualifications for a university, but I applied nonetheless, and they made a great exception. They allowed me to do the degree course, but because I didn't have the qualifications for a degree, I got the same piece of paper at the end of 5 years. But instead of saying degree, it said diploma. So there was a very nice twist there.
You won a claim as a young architect in the UK for some buildings that really pushed the boundaries in some fairly unfashionable places. An insurance office in Ipswich with curved glass walls and a roof garden that was very novel at the time. A Renault car centre in Swindon, of all places, which you could actually mistake for an art gallery. But the building that established your international reputation was in Hong Kong, the Hong Kong and Shanghai Bank, a very distinctive design, making a virtue again of structural elements. Do you look back on that landmark building as the scheme that turned you from a British architect into a global architect?
It's interesting that Bob Stern, who was the dean of the Yale School of Architecture, suggested that the genesis of the Hong Kong building was a project that I did as a student at Yale, where I broke through a number of kind of prejudices and suggested that I worked with an engineer. And so the Hong Kong Bank was revolutionary in the way that it took out the central core. So all high-rise buildings before Hong Kong Bank was a ribbon of space around a central core of structure and services. Hong Kong Bank kind of took those and put them on the side of open loft spaces. So for the first time, you could see through such a building. And interestingly, it became perhaps the first headquarters that was able, as a tall building, to take a dealer's floor, because of course for a dealer you need a line of sight. So each of these buildings that we're describing, they all pushed the boundaries to do something which was different, not different for the sake of being different, but different in terms of offering a better quality of life, a better lifestyle.
Another building which really enhanced your reputation was the Reichstag building in Berlin. It opened in 1999. It was another hit and something of a new departure. There was a blend of the modern, a stunning new dome, and also the historic, the old Parliament building. How did you balance those elements to pull off that marriage?
The dome element was triggered by a movement to bring back a replica of the historic original 19th century dome, which was a symbol of an authoritarian regime. And under pressure to do such a thing, and I remember at the time saying that there was no way that we were ever going to replicate a historic dome from the past. And that triggered the idea of a dome that would be a symbol of democracy in action. And it became part of a holistic ecological design that produced effectively a zero carbon public building. But that also came out of the interview process in terms of suggesting that the politicians should have the opportunity to set an example to the nation at large by effectively doing a zero carbon building. Now, the whole idea of sustainability is something that we had been and have continually been pushing since the birth of the practice in the 1960s. But the Reichstag was a public demonstration of that manifesto, a green manifesto, as it later became known. So really the ecological, sustainable story, the idea of inviting the public and that the public being symbolically above the politicians who are answerable to them. Of course, all of this had to be agreed with politicians who had been trained to disagree with each other and to challenge each other. So finding consensus was quite an experience.
You're listening to ABC Saturday Extra with me, Nick Bryan, and I'm interviewing Lord Foster, probably the world's most famous and celebrated architect. Lord Foster, you are known for the design of your Apple store, that sleek design aesthetic, and also Apple's headquarters in Cupertino in California, which brought about a collaboration with the great tech innovator of our age, Steve Jobs. I wonder what it was like to work with him.
Well, after he sadly passed away, I had the task of communicating that vision which he created. The opening image I showed was his portrait, and next to it, a quote, "Don't think of me as your client, think of me as a member of the team." That perhaps sums up the spirit of the project. I mean, it was a call out of the blue saying, "Hi, Norman, I'm here in Cupertino. I need some help. How quickly can you get here?" And two or three weeks later, we were together in the meeting room. We were together in a car going across the freeways, ending up in the kitchen with the family with pizza. And that was really the birth of the project and the working relationship that was quite extraordinary. And the language, perhaps, of that building is encapsulated in the stores.
And I've read that at one point in the process of designing the Apple campus, you were struggling to get where you wanted to get to. And Steve Jobs said something which I was struck by. He said that every project needs a crisis moment.
Well, I think that the building as a circle looks like it was almost a kind of one-liner, because there is a seeming inevitability about it. But perhaps to explain that phrase, it was a struggle over some 9 or 10 months of design development when we were struggling to resolve the integration of his ideal pod. You're really working hard to resolve how a building works internally and what its expression is externally. And so if you can imagine all these different curvilinear shapes of buildings evolving over this 8 or 9 month period, and then late in that period, there's the moment where you're absolutely desperate, and then suddenly you have that accumulated knowledge, and presto, you realize that the circular building will do the trick. And it was that kind of fulfillment, resolution of the crisis, because at that point, as a designer, you've accumulated a lot of knowledge about the site, about the inner workings of Apple, the demands of their programmers, and then eureka. It suddenly seems so obvious and so simple. But I use the analogy of an iceberg. You see the tip of an iceberg, it's the built building, it's the physicality. What you do not see is the vast amount that lies below the surface. Call it the process, the struggle.
Let's talk about your latest project in America. You've just designed the new JP Morgan Chase Tower in New York, a new addition to the world's most famous skyline. The Wall Street Journal has called it a thrilling addition. I wonder whether you feel an extra sense of responsibility when you are adding to such a famous and much-loved cityscape.
Well, I think there's another even deeper dimension to it, and that is that the building that it replaced was quite a modern classic of its period. But events have overtaken that period. So the demands of today are different from those in the 1950s. You need more ceiling height. You need more service space. You have the incorporation of much more advanced technology. You have greater awareness of the implications of energy consumption, different perception of the workplace in terms of the facilities that it needs to incorporate. But what we were able to achieve by the design, by the cantilevers, so this building comes down on a fan-like structure. So although we increase the density by twice, so there are twice the number of people, it's twice as high, but it is delivering at the ground level something like 2.5 times more public space at the base than the previous building. And we have to remember that a city which is dense and walkable, like New York, which is a high-rise version, but we could be talking about a city like London or Paris, those cities which are dense and walkable, their carbon footprint is half that of the sprawling car-borne city. So a number of factors, the fact that Manhattan itself, by virtue of its public transport, its density, is a sustainable model, and then the JP Morgan skyscraper is powered by hydroelectricity, and in that sense is operationally is virtually zero carbon.
I know you're a great fan of the Chrysler Building. It's certainly my favorite skyscraper in New York. I was in New York recently. And I was worried that the Chrysler Building was getting slightly crowded out. And some people have said the same thing is happening in the City of London, and it's crowding out one of your famous skyscrapers, the Gherkin. Is there a danger that our cityscapes are becoming too congested?
Probably over the centuries, there's been similar phrases at various points in time as cities have become more developed. So those buildings that hopefully are extraordinary historic symbols of their time are protected. But the city itself is organic. It's always evolving. It's always responding to change. In that sense, I think that the Chrysler Building at the time, and I recall using images of it when it was really very much on its own in the 30s. But I think that relationship is different, but it's still a wonderful masterpiece of its time. And I perhaps argue that a city that has buildings from different periods in the past, in the end, is richer by that juxtaposition.
Lord Foster, you've spoken a lot about sustainability. I wonder whether I can raise the issue of affordability. So many cities in the world right now, whether it's New York City or Sydney or London, have this affordability problem. I wonder what role architecture can play in solving that.
It's a very, very valid question. And the foundation, the Norman Foster Foundation, which is headquartered in Madrid, has been working with industry at different levels to demonstrate the potential of delivering an affordable housing units in Costa Rica, where we are at scale going to be delivering a home at something like $15,000-$16,000. Now, that's very different from perhaps the kind of home in a different context. So if I think about the work that we're doing with a consortium of Portuguese industries, and we have an exhibition at the moment, the foundation showing a number of its projects. One of these is a built module, if you can imagine it as a container-like module, but showing the potential of delivering quite high-quality units, originally started with student accommodation, but it's now expanded outwards. So that potential of industrializing is arguably the only way that you're going to be able to significantly drive down costs of affordable housing.
Lord Foster, this year you celebrated your 90th birthday. I wonder whether that has made you reflect on what you think is your single biggest contribution to global architecture.
I don't think I'm the best person to judge that. I think history is, and others. I would perhaps reflect that over the decades, the quest to seek a resolution of beauty, sustainability, has really shown the potential to have a relationship with the natural world, to be able to point the way to a more sustainable future.
Just one final question. You're designing a new stadium for Manchester United, the new Old Trafford. It's a really ambitious project. How important is it for you to return to the city where you grew up and to design what will be a monumental structure?
I think it's just a great combination because Manchester United football, the fans, the expectations, the creation of a space that will somehow capture the spectacle, the roar, all of those qualities, tangible and intangible, and in the process to regenerate an industrial quarter of Manchester, which coincidentally was where my father worked in Metropolitan Vicars in Old Trafford. So there's a kind of continuum of completing the circle in that sense. So yes, that's very satisfying.
And for young architects out there listening to this who want to be the next Norman Foster, what's your advice?
Follow the advice that I try to follow myself, and that is to stay a student. And what do I mean by that? Well, as a student, you can challenge, you have to be a good listener, you can take risks, but above all, you should stay humble.
As a young architectural student myself, you're a great inspiration to me. Alongside My Bed is still a book with your works in it. Lord Foster, it's been a great pleasure to interview you. Thanks for joining us on Saturday Extra.
Well, thank you.
That was the British architect and global star architect, Lord Norman Foster.
On ABC Radio National, science isn't just about finding answers.
It's about asking better questions.
Why 39 times?
Great question.
From the frontiers of discovery
to the mysteries of the mind
and the moments where science and humanity collide.
Discover the science that shapes our lives
and the questions that will define what comes next.
Quantum biology.
It's an emerging field.
But here's the gobsmacking thing.
ABC Radio National.
Where science lives.
On ABC Radio National, I'm Nick Bryant, and this is Saturday Extra. Now to a female journalist who's been described as one of the most influential women of the 21st century. In 2018, Maria Ressa was named the Time Person of the Year for her work at the news website she co-founded, Rappler, chronicling the extrajudicial killings and human rights abuses of the then president of the Philippines, Rodrigo Duterte. Then in 2021, she was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize, along with a Russian journalist, Dmitry Muratov, for her efforts to safeguard freedom of expression. She's in the forefront of the campaign to stop the spread of misinformation. And I caught up with her when she was in Australia earlier this year to deliver an address at the National Press Club. Maria Ressa, thanks so much for joining us on Saturday Extra.
Nick, thanks for having me.
Maria, you're not just one of the great journalists of our time. You're a journalistic leader, a clarion voice in our industry. Journalists traditionally have been seen as observers in conflict. They bear testimony. They share with the world what's going on. Over the course of your career, do you think that authoritarian governments in particular, and even democratic governments, see journalists more as enemy combatants, as fair game in a conflict zone?
It's shifted, and it's very, very interesting how and where it shifted, right? Because it literally shifted in our part of the world. I remember I'm coming up on my 40th year as a journalist in February, and the shift when journalists became targeted, right? It was for a long time. I remember Falun Til guerrillas, the communist rebels in the Philippines, right? They want you to follow and they want you to go to the jungle. But it all changed around 1997, and it was in Indonesia first when journalists became targets. And the first journalist who was killed, and this was before Iraq, was actually in East Timor. I don't know if you remember this, but it was in Indonesia first, white journalists were targeted. And then in East Timor, during that time period when East Timor became absolutely chaotic, and Interfet came in, Australia came in, and my team from CNN at that point is a brown team. So we drove in by land, but we were driving down this road that just a little while earlier, a Dutch journalist named Sander Tornes had driven down on a motorcycle, and he was the first journalist killed. The first journalist killed in Iraq also came from that East Timor conflict, right? And from then, journalists were fair game. And of course, the worst that we've come to is Gaza. Why do we still keep doing this, Nick?
Maria, let's talk about how you made your name by exposing the extrajudicial killings and human rights abuses of Rodrigo Duterte, the former president of the Philippines. This was a classic example of a news organization, Rappler, which you co-founded, speaking truth to power, and also of power trying to crush the truth. Tell us about how the Duterte government tried to silence you.
You know, it's funny. I think every journalist is going through something similar around the world now. First, it's technology that enabled this, right? The elections, the meta-narratives that were seeded as early as 2014, and then the elections of these illiberal leaders democratically. Duterte was the first of the fall of those political dominoes. After Duterte, about a month later, you had Brexit. After that, you had, by November, Donald Trump 1.0, and then so on, right? But I think what he tried to do first were online attacks, social media attacks against me and Rappler. And the median age in Rappler is 23 years old. We're 63% women. Not by design, but what happened was I began, coordinated attacks began to attack me, and I was getting an average of 90 hate messages per hour.
Right.
That was in 2016, and they seeded the meta-narrative, hashtag arrest Maria Ressa, in 2017, and that was followed by lawfare, legal investigations, and by 2019, the beginning of the arrest, I was arrested in 2019, and in a little over a year, I had 11 criminal charges. So that was both personal and organizational. The government tried to shut us down. We would have gotten shut down because in 2018, when the government tried to shut us down, it also told our advertisers to drop. And so we dropped in 4 months, 49% of our advertising revenue. So you can see this, right? Like, first, it's kill the reputation, kill the spirit, and then pile on legal cases so that the news group dies. I don't know how, but we survived. Actually, I do know how.
I was going to ask you. I mean, that level of intimidation would cow and silence, I think, many journalists. And understandably, it didn't cow and silence you. Why not?
I don't think it would have cowed and silenced you, Nick. There's so many journalists in our... You know, we grew up at the golden age of journalism. That's the way I feel, you know. And I think that time period... First, at the beginning, I was on autopilot because I was like, this is wrong. What the government is doing is wrong. So I just kept going until I actually got arrested. And I was like, oh my God, there's something new here. And that's when I realized the world was being turned upside down. I think we survived by going offline, going to our community. And, you know, you don't know who you are until you're forced to stand up for what you believe in. And in that sense, you know, President Duterte forced me to define who I was. If I was everything I said I was, I just followed the path. I kept walking the path. And then I, you know, what the other part is... what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. It made Rappler extremely strong during this time period because when they tried to take away our business, we were forced to find another sustainable business model. And we did. And we're the only news organization in the Philippines that hasn't laid off any people, right? Like, you find crisis is opportunity. Here's the last part. I was surprised by the kindness of strangers. In that time period, we could not have survived this if we didn't have this kind of support behind us. Every time I got arrested, there would be a wave of money that would come in from people. And I just kept reminding my sales team, this is not a sustainable business model. You know, it's having said that, our community became stronger. You realize the role that fear plays. And that the only way to stand up is to hold the line, right? Because, and I'm hoping Americans understand this, the rights you voluntarily give up is so hard to reclaim. I've learned this, right? I still have one court case left. It's at the Supreme Court, the Court of Last Appeal. I still have to ask for permission to travel outside the Philippines. Right? And it's been, by 2016, it'll be 9 years.
But we should say, Maria, that the legal action has shifted.
Ah,
tell us
yes.
about that. Tell us who at the moment is residing in a detention cell in The Hague.
Isn't that interesting? Look, in March this year, the ICC issued an arrest warrant for crimes against humanity for Rodrigo Duterte. And my government, the Philippine government, arrested him based on Interpol's warrant and sent him to The Hague. So the man who tried to jail me for a century, cumulatively a century, I'm still free. I still have to ask for permission to travel, but I'm free. And I think one of the things we have to realize now is how fluid the world is, how impunity has become the norm, how rule of law has been challenged all around the world. And I think this development, that in a short period of time, the killings under this brutal drug war that the families will have some sense of justice. I have to say, just seeing him arrested and brought on the plane and flown to The Hague, I was like, oh my gosh, there is some sense of justice, and I want to see where the trial goes.
On Radio National, Saturday Extra, I'm Nick Bryant, speaking with the Nobel Peace Prize laureate and journalist, Maria Ressa. Maria, you wrote a book based on the experience entitled How to Stand Up to a Dictator. It didn't only focus on the Philippines. You're worried about the rise of authoritarianism all over the world, the death of democracy by a thousand cuts, as you put it. Tell us what you mean by that.
Enabled by technology. Right. What we went through in the Philippines is that, you know, we elected a man who literally within 6 months crushed the checks and balances of our institutions. I got to point out it's happened even faster in the United States. Right. So be careful. And death by a thousand cuts. I always said this to Filipinos that, you know, you think this is just for every cut. They seem so small, even a paper cut, but you're bleeding out. And at some point, the body politic dies. We did under Duterte. But, you know, I joke now we went from hell to purgatory. We're under President Marcos. The irony of President Marcos arresting former President Duterte and holding him, sending him for justice, right? So there's that. But what we're seeing is that a lot of these things, the information operations, the attacks against journalists, the attacks against human rights activists, the attacks against facts, breaking down truth and creating chaos to erase trust, this is happening all around the world. We are literally electing illiberal leaders democratically. As of March this year, VDEM in Sweden said that 72% of the world is now under authoritarian rule. So be careful about where you get your information, right? Our public information ecosystem online is not anchored on facts. And the very design of these tech companies are actually, they spread lies faster than facts. And if you use fear, anger, and hate, you can go viral.
You've met Mark Zuckerberg, the head of Meta, which obviously owns Facebook. You made the case to Mark Zuckerberg. What did you say to him? And what did he say in response?
This was in 2017 in a lunch that we were having with a group of startup founders. I was the only journalist in the room. And I was telling him what role Facebook was playing, that it was essentially our de facto internet. At that point, 97% of Filipinos on the internet were on Facebook. Facebook is our internet. And he looked at me after I said 97% and he was frowning. And I was like, okay, what did I just say? I invited him to come to the Philippines, right? And then he turned to me and he said, wait, Maria, where are the other 3%? And that's when I realized, oh my God. Well, he does want world domination. I would say Facebook did that, but I hope in How to Stand Up to a Dictator, there were two men there. One was Rodrigo Duterte, who is now in prison in The Hague, and the other dictator is Mark Zuckerberg. He was not elected, and yet he determines what comes up on your feed, and it doesn't have to be factual. So these are things that I think we should be demanding better from him.
One of the things that struck many people about President Donald Trump's inauguration was the prominent seats that were given to these princes of big tech, figures such as Jeff Bezos, the founder of Amazon, figures such as Mark Zuckerberg. Maria, they got better seats than the most senior incoming cabinet members of the Trump administration. When you saw that happen, you know, inaugurations are great, people watching, they're great, power watching as well. When you saw that happen, what did you think?
Power and money, kleptocracy, right? That it's going to get even worse. Because I think the difference, when news organizations were the gatekeepers to our public information ecosystem, there was a set of standards and ethics. These tech CEOs are there for business. And that means it is about power and money. And they've now been given the front row. We saw this a little bit with Elon Musk and Doge, right? These tech companies, there's a great book by Mariska Shaked called The Tech Coup, right? Essentially that these tech companies have created a coup and that governments are losing their power, and every day they do not reclaim it, they lose more power every day. This is the greatest challenge globally now. We cannot have a shared reality if the tech companies continue to print money, or no longer print money, if they are allowed to continue making money without regard for safety, right? And that is what, I think there are two groups that abdicated responsibility for protecting our public information ecosystem. The first is those tech companies, but the second are democratic governments that did not create a public interest tech stack in the virtual world, right? The ideal world is the laws in the physical world are mirrored in the virtual world. As it is, as it stands right now, these tech CEOs are using the same tactics as a Putin in terms of, you know, how to crush a democracy. You use social media, so media capture. After media capture, you do academic capture, NGO capture, and state capture. Having them at the front row, it's a scary thing when it's a transactional American presidency.
Let's talk about Donald Trump. You're spending a lot of time in America at the moment. You're at Columbia University, which along with Harvard is one of the elite Ivy School academic institutions that the Trump administration has targeted. How worried are you about a slide towards authoritarianism in what is supposed to be the beacon of democracy, the United States of America?
I don't think it's just a slide. I think what we saw happen in the Philippines when, you know, our constitution in the Philippines is patterned after the United States, three branches of co-equal branches of government. And what we saw was a very strong president ruling by decree and a legislature that collapsed and enabled him. And then you rely on a judiciary that is essentially targeted one by one, right? Power and money. I think that's what we're seeing in the United States now. In the first 100 days of President Trump, he issued 147 executive orders. I just got to remind you that the first President Marcos in 1973 declared martial law by executive order, right? And so it's not gradual. It's been very fast. And I think Americans need to realize that this is a government acting for them. Are these their values, and they need to do more. You know, what does civic engagement look like in the age of exponential lies? How can we bring back checks and balances? These are questions that are very real for Americans right now, and where America goes, it will pull the world.
Well, that's an interesting point to go to the sort of history of America. I mean, throughout its 250-year story, the country is often liked strongman leaders.
Yeah.
Trump won the nationwide vote after people had seen what happened on January the 6th, 2021, with a storming of the U.S. Capitol. They know he has authoritarian tendencies. They know he has anti-democratic tendencies. And yet they still voted for him.
So I'll give you two things that that we were tracking. The first is the Cambridge Analytical whistleblower, Christopher Wiley, said that in 2016, they created Facebook accounts targeting young boys in every county in America. Fast forward that to 2024, right? Several things happened again, and this is where I do believe technology enabled this. It plays with our worst fears, creates an us against them. And what you're seeing, the two fracture lines that have been pounded open, not just in America, but in many countries around the world, is gender and race, right? So that's, again, for young white men, there's so much more to say here, but we did a 3-year deep dive into the information ecosystem in America and the role technology plays. And it is not. I think the question that you have, which I ask now all the time, is do we as voters still have agency, given that there are no effective laws in place to prevent the insidious manipulation of our emotions that changes the way we see the world, the way we act, the way we vote?
The English radical Thomas Paine once said, at the founding of the American Republic, the cause of America is in great measure the cause of all mankind. I wonder if that's how you see America now, as the battleground for democracy.
So the difference, I think, between the Philippines and America is that we ousted a Marcos, a dictator, in 1986 in a people power revolt. And those seeds of resistance were still there. The organizations were still there. We were able to recover. Plus the brutal killings and the families that worked against it. I think Americans have to get out of the fear, that the fear, yes, it can accomplish a lot, but they need to figure out what civic engagement is. Otherwise, if they lose their democracy, and they're well on the road to that, then the rest of the world needs to look at what it will look like. I think this is why in November 2021, and this is before the Trump 2.0, right? I said, we're standing on the rubble of the world that was an atomic bomb, like Hiroshima. An atomic bomb exploded in our information ecosystem. And now it's gotten even worse than that. And so we have to stand on the rubble and look at what we want to build. It is this moment. For Australians, you are in our region, right? Like, what can we build that can be better? What can we do when the leadership has shifted, when the kinds of coalitions of governance have turned upside down?
Finally, Maria Ressa, you have a Nobel Peace Prize, something which Donald Trump covets. I wonder what sort of sense of pride comes with that. And I wonder what sort of sense of responsibility comes with that.
I was given my right to travel again. So on a personal front, the Nobel Peace Prize was an acknowledgement of the injustice. That's personal. But beyond that, I would say for the last 2 decades or so, you've seen attacks against journalists increasing while the quality of democracy decreases. So it was a recognition of what journalists are having to go through. We talked about Gaza. The other parts, it's a great way to pull people together, communities of action.
Maria Ressa, it has been a treat to talk to you on Saturday Extra. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Nick.
Maria Ressa, the founder of Rappler and a Nobel Peace Prize laureate.
On ABC Radio National,
we examine the forces that shape how we live.
And who we have become.
Health services fail Australians.
Governor of the Reserve Bank, Michelle Bullock.
From the economy.
To the big ideas.
From fearless debates.
To the events that timestamp our lives.
A political eruption across the United States.
Russia. China. And they have veto.
Go deep.
To challenge.
To question.
And explore our complex world.
ABC Radio National.
Now to space, the final frontier, and Australia's first female astronaut, the smasher of a galactic glass ceiling. Catherine Bennell-Pegg is one of only about 100 space-ready astronauts in the world. She's also the first to be trained under the Australian flag. She brought a bit of star power to Saturday Extra.
Basically, when you're selected as an astronaut, which for me came after a year and a half of 6 knockout rounds, you don't get to call yourself an astronaut right away. You have to do what's called astronaut candidate training or basic training, and that's between 1 and 2 years. And it's only when you pass that that you get your astronaut wings and you're qualified as an astronaut and eligible to be nominated for a mission by your country to the International Space Station or even beyond.
I wonder how an Aussie astronaut gets a ride. How are you going to get into space?
Well, there's only a few space agencies around the world, actually, with astronauts, but a lot are working to get into this world. So the countries that have human spaceflight programs are like the US, Japan, Europe, including the UK, India, Canada, and Russia and UAE. China's doing their own thing, so it's really incredible Australia is now included in this group, but it's not that. If you perform on the training, you get tapped on the shoulder and sent up. Really, it's up to your country if they wish to pursue this path. And it's really early days for Australia. So step by step, you know, some astronauts wait over a decade for a flight. Others never fly. Nothing's guaranteed. So right now I'm really concentrated on, you know, being as match fit as I can, but mostly on creating opportunities to for our researchers to benefit from what they can do in these big space stations, which are big flying labs in space, and getting out and about across our country to speak to young people, especially about, you know, the opportunities and joy in a STEM career and backing themselves to dream big.
That was Catherine Bennell-Pegg, Australia's first female astronaut. On ABC Radio National, I'm Nick Bryant, and after the news, we're heading to the bottom of the ocean with one of the world's great writers, the Irish novelist, Colm McCann.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.